ladies ever.
Thank you, Dr. May. It has really been exciting, fun, enriching, every good thing that you can say to be the chair of this steering committee. And on behalf of the 11 Southern Baptist Convention agencies and auxiliary who called and who planned and who initially financed this first nationwide Southern Baptist consultation on women in church-related vocations, I give you an official welcome. We come here tonight from many different places, and we are going in many different directions, geographically, spiritually, and experientially. We do not know each other yet, but I expect we will very well shortly. But I think that we can assume one thing in common among ourselves, and that is an interest in some aspect of this key question. Can a Southern Baptist woman today find happiness on the payroll of a Southern Baptist board, agency, institution, or church? Or to put it on a more practical level, can she even find such a job? And if she does, will she be able to function with the same number of perks and expectations as any other employee of that employer? Now, this is not an idle question or an issue off to the side of a more key issue. State Baptist Conventions and their various appendages and SBC-level entities employ an estimated 20,000 persons, and their staffs are growing. The 35,000 Southern Baptist churches, and I dare say that with our very militant church extension strategies now in the field, this number will quickly be 36,000 or even more. These people employ untold thousands on their staffs, and perhaps 60,000 would be a conservative figure of the professional staff positions now being filled at the church level alone. Now, if our church and denominational employment profile were to match the national profile on employment of women, at least 40% of these jobs would be filled by women, with the percentage growing. But according to the latest studies done, and I'll have to say that there are no extremely reliable studies on this field, the percentage is declining, and our profile does not match the national picture. And perhaps a more significant element is that certain categories of jobs are virtually closed to women today. So this consultation will seek to examine this question because of three reasons. One, and to me personally, a very important one, is that we must be scrupulously honest in educating, training, and guiding the young women and girls who are now coming along through our churches about their reasonable expectation for life professional service in this denomination. And in so doing, we must stop dangling terms such as freedom, life commitment, call of God, priesthood of the believer, personal accountability, and church-related vocations before their ears, eyes, and noses if they are not supposed to hear, see, and appropriate them. Say it's a good amen in audience here. We're going to have a good week, I can tell that. A second reason. Our colleges and seminaries are becoming noticeably populated by women students who expect to fulfill a personal call of God in any one of a gamut of denominational job descriptions, and there seems to be a gap between their expectations and job availability. If the gap is not bridged quickly, the result could be disastrous, not only for individuals, but also for programs. I would even venture to say the future of our denomination. A third reason. Southern Baptists, meanwhile, have embarked upon a phenomenal program of church extension, witness, and ministry that depends to some extent on doubling the number of missionaries on our boards and agencies' payrolls today. And this, in turn, will probably escalate a correlated increase in all types of leadership and employment throughout the denomination. Now, the denominational employers, or at least those who are represented in the sponsorship of this consultation, have the wisdom enough to know that a talent pool large enough to fund and provide this increase in employment immediately must include every person who is able, and that would even include women. Now, these three reasons lie behind this consultation. Now, for a little specific information about how we happen to come to this place today and how the wheels of the denominational machinery ground around to making this consultation a reality. First of all, there was a discussion in the Missions Coordination Subcommittee of the Interagency Council about Bold Mission Thrust, which you have heard of. Bold Mission Thrust, I do not like to label on every good thing that comes along in our denomination because not everything that we do is missions, and we will make a mistake if we try to excuse everything we do as being part of Bold Mission Thrust. But we were talking in very realistic terms about where we would get the human resources necessary for what we're talking about in Bold Mission Thrust. And it was decided that a key question is the employment of women. Therefore, we wanted to have this consultation. According to procedures, this needed to be approved by the Interagency Council, and it was. At this point, I think it is significant to pay tribute to approximately 50 men and 2 women who said, yes, there should be this consultation, and then who withdrew largely from the active participation in forming it to allow more women to have a voice in framing this meeting. Then all the agencies were given an opportunity to participate specifically in the sponsorship, meaning that they would contribute to a seed fund to get it going, although all of us have participated in the funding through our registration fees, and more importantly, they would contribute the staff necessary to plan and conduct it. From this invitation to all the agencies, the 11 who are listed in some of your registration material responded in the affirmative, and they appointed representatives to a steering committee and also to subcommittees to handle the arrangements for this meeting. In your registration packet, there was a blue sheet entitled To Whom Credit Is Due, and tonight you have been given one that was not in the packet, More To Whom Credit Is Due. And you will see that a lot of people have labored very diligently in making this meeting come to reality. Now, right off the bat, we had to make some decisions about logistics of this consultation, and it was decided to have a small consultation of people who really were interested in the subject, had a stake in it, could really influence change in the field, and we also were limited in the number who could participate by the site which we chose, compliments of the Sunday School Board. And it was decided that approximately 300 would be our optimum size. As of this moment, we have 295 persons registered for this consultation. It's interesting to observe on first glance that you come from 25 states from coast to coast. You seem to have, according to an earlier count before we got up to 295, 202 women, 68 men, and 7 unclassified. I think that it is interesting to note that our objectives concerning job types who would be here have been well fulfilled. We hoped, first of all, to guarantee that those who have the most clout in hiring, firing, and educating in this convention would be present, and most of them are. And then we hope to allow room for any interested woman or man or any church staff member or anybody else out there in the wild blue yonder of 13 million Southern Baptists who heard of this consultation and wanted to come could, and so far we have not had to turn anybody away. So that means that we have 20 persons who are state and SBC top executives with hiring and policymaking responsibility. We have 134 other state SBC convention employees, including many people who have influence in the area of education and job hiring. We have 8 campus ministers, 26 pastors, church staff, and chaplains, 36 miscellaneous church members, 36 seminary and college administrators and faculty, and 30 seminary and college students. And later we will break down these demographic facts a little bit more thoroughly and let you know for sure who is here. I think that it is commendable that the agencies who decided to sponsor and be public... Then it is time that they be replaced with someone who is dedicated to doing the will and work of the Lord, not the devil. And so, here we are. And I guess that we might as well also publicly say here right now because it has been publicly said to the contrary very loudly and widely by one or two vocal people, that this is not a consultation to decide the issue of ordination and tell the churches what they are supposed to do about it. Nobody here is foolish enough to try to speak for or even to all Southern Baptist churches. I think that we also must recognize as part of our responsibility in participating in this consultation that women in our convention aspire to many thousands of jobs that have nothing whatsoever to do with ordination. Ordination may be one issue, yes, but it is not the hidden agenda of this consultation. Now, it is also necessary at the same time to recognize that in this consultation, we cannot attempt to deal with every aspect of the many women's movements in our society at this time. We're only going to focus in on one, and that is the issue of employment in church-related vocations. Now, along with this one question, of course, there are many factors that have bearing. And with your help, through discussion periods and reaction periods, it is our hope that every one of these, whatever it is, will be surfaced and discussed for the benefit of those who are participating. And as another given, let us affirm at this time that we do not intend to violate any of the sacred tenets of Southern Baptist polity. We will not decide anything for the churches here, nor will we decide anything for the structures of the denomination which the churches have created and which they control. So what are we going to accomplish here? What will be the outcome? Number one, a volume of findings, a faithful record of what is said here. Two, these findings will go to the interagency council corporately and to its individual member agencies. And what they do with it will be in large measure up to you. Three, we will gain from this personal insight. And four, we will have more equipment to use in our personal influence and leadership wherever we are. And this is probably the most powerful thing that we have. And it is certainly the most effective thing that we have given the context of Southern Baptist operations, leadership, and drifts today. All of these really are powerful avenues of response. And because they are powerful, there will be change because of what happens here. And I, for one, and I think you too, like very much to be standing on the brink, looking back into what brought us to this time, and knowing through our background reading and our personal experiences and pilgrimages to this point, knowing much of what has been good and not so good in our heritage, but also looking into the future and see what we can become. I recently discovered that W.O. Carver, who was a great leader and scholar in the field of missions, where incidentally we have had all of our impetus for improvement in the lot of women in this convention, in 1941 he made a splendid address on this subject, and I doubt that anything will be said in this consultation that he was not already saying at that time in behalf of the increase of women's leadership in the field of missions. And he said this: Christianity is not a warfare against men and groups with other ideas. It is a society of witness to the kingdom of God. In the social order, Christians constitute leaven, not dynamite, not social dynamite, but spiritually dynamic Christianity. It releases the power of God in a gospel, but does not accumulate force to enforce claims. A too masculine cast has been given to the interpretations and expositions of the Bible. Jesus Christ has not been thoroughly understood, nor his mind found full expression in the polity and procedures of our churches today. Now, though, the time has come when women in their freedom must accept the challenge of a high calling and the demand of themselves, and the demand that men reevaluate themselves and a readjustment of social responsibility. The hope of the hour and of the future lies with Christian womanhood, emancipated from masculine subordination by the freedom of truth in Jesus Christ, and Christian men and women working together in the high calling of God in Jesus Christ for the saving of mankind to the glory of God. He was speaking to young women at that time. And in the first step in our sensitivity tonight, as we get ready to participate in this consultation, we look again to the young.
Oh, no, it's set with the Lebesnopser day of the unit. I'll hear for that. A sure ring is here, and it's a head. Door and night, not see who's known it. So much yelliger, sure, so short, stable, and it's so short, so I owe it.
Look again at the front of your program and note the purpose. We have wrestled with it, and we keep going back over and over again to keep ourselves on target. As established by the assignment from the Interagency Council to develop a body of findings for use by all denominational agencies in employment, policymaking, education programs, and vocational guidance. Toward this outcome, this consultation has three objectives, and I wish to relate to the first. Number one, to define the present situation in the SBC with regard to women in church-related vocations. We did some digging without all that much fanfare, and we're well aware that there are four primary locations of data that are available for anyone who wants to go to it, dig it out, and abide by the policies of that agency. Again, we are involved in a very delicate area of autonomy. Alice McGill, who's been a part of the steering committee and subcommittees in the preparation for this consultation, works at the Sunday School Board in vocational guidance under the and church administration. She keeps very extensive files on young people who have made commitment at our assemblies and other events. Foreign Mission Board has extensive files. Home Mission Board, extensive files. Each of the seminaries, extensive files with information on both men and women. Those, according to the policy of those agencies, you can have access to any of that information. But there were two things that were missing. So to add to the body of information, we worked, we formed a subcommittee for research. As an interesting subcommittee, Phil Jones of the Home Mission Board. Phil, would you stand? And, of course, you'll need to work your way on over to the overhead projector you'll be operating. He's a product of the post-war baby boom, the radicals of the late 1960s, and he came by way of the Home Mission Board, Georgia Tech. He was a part-time student and helped us. He is research consultant at the Home Mission Board and worked on the committee, and he's just one real fine fella. Alan Neely. Alan, will you rise and move over to the location for the other one? Alan is missions professor at Southeastern Seminary with experience in foreign missions. He comes from the academic field. And we were very fortunate to have working with us Paula Clayton of Raleigh, North Carolina, who is a student and works with Dr. Neely. And in her work, she did a lot of the, what I'm sure looked like a lot of busy work, but was very important basic work, and we will share with you in just a moment some of the information that she helped pull together. Paula, will you stand, please? And I'm the graying old or middle-aged bureaucrat to round out the team. Our young lady, well, I won't go over Phil's credentials again, but here we go. The two missing elements, A, is seminary enrollment. Can you find that critter? That's women enrolled in our seminaries. Now, for those of you who are far in the back, it's difficult to see, but we have listed, through Paula's preparation, the Associates in Divinity, Diploma in Theology, various degrees. 22% are women. Diploma in Religious Education, about 40% are women. Diploma in church music out of the, well, there was 13, four of which were women, 30%. Master of Divinity program, about 5%, 4,117 men, 233 women. Master of Religious Education runs about 44% women. Master of Church Music, 25%. And on down, this will be a part of the findings. B, an employment survey was made to try to piece together another element of missing data. What about women who are employed by our Southern Baptist Convention agencies? Annuity Board, Brotherhood Commission, Christian Life, and on down the list, in executive offices, in administrative and supervisory positions, clerical accounting, computer positions, building maintenance, total employees by each of the agencies. Now we had, all totaled, this one doesn't have it. There are about 1,211, I think was the figure, wasn't it, Phil, roughly that, total number of females employed in our SBC agencies in maintenance to clerical to administrative supervisory to executive offices throughout our agencies. In a survey that was distributed to all of them, there were two agencies that, due to a number of circumstances, did not participate. And very likely, it's my opinion from a researcher standpoint, it was well that they weren't, for a couple of reasons. One was the Sunday School Board and the other was the Annuity Board. They are quite unique in terms of the general thrust of our agencies. The Sunday School Board in this environment of Nashville has been faced with numerous pressures of all kinds, taxes and everything else. They also have to employ such tremendous number of persons of all walks of life without regard to their religious commitment that the overall study would be tremendously biased by an agency of this size. And I had the privilege of being involved in a fairly extensive discussion. We could have said we will only go to a certain portion of the population at the Sunday School Board, but that would distort our findings. It would build in a bias that would make it difficult to be comfortable with whatever we came out with. So with that in mind, we recognize that, let's go to C, we recognize that we miss about half of the total women employees, but the unique nature of those two agencies would totally color and bias the overall findings. We were looking for career and advancement opportunities and their feelings about it. We wanted to see if there's indications of sexism, that is, a bias toward or against women, the sense of satisfaction about working in the agencies, if there was a sense of calling, what degree that calling was, and on the list goes. We distributed about 735 questionnaires. We had 524 come back, and that's a 71% coverage. One of our agencies came through with 95%, another one with 89%, another one with 83%, which I think is phenomenal. The distribution of materials related to the seminaries, 193, and we had 99 returned. It was difficult to know how many of the women in the seminaries regard themselves as full-time employees, and the distribution process, we had some difficulty there. But we still feel somewhat comfortable that we got enough coverage that it really wouldn't create any problems. Let's knock the lights for a minute and let me share the opening statements on the research material that you'll have in your packet. And I would encourage you to read it because I wrote it. Just that simple. Nevertheless, a fairly large number of women employed in our agencies expressed strong negative feelings about their employment at a Southern Baptist Convention agency. Yet, on the other hand, 83% were very positive in that they felt that working in their particular agency gave them a great sense of worthwhile accomplishment. And there's, as we go through the data, it seems to be somewhat contradictory. We will see. Though the responses to several items indicated substantial dissatisfaction with the organization, there was virtually no sufficient support to a sexism charge. It was by no means a dominant factor in any stretch of the imagination. Most of the discontent seemed to be focused toward feelings that, quote, once a typist, always a typist. That is, the organization did not have an aggressive program that encourages or permits women to advance up the career ladder in their agency. Though one of the hypotheses talks about a minority that feel that the organization is unfair toward women employees, the data indicated that nearly 40% feel that management jobs are generally closed to women. About 10% more were uncertain, and another 10% just didn't answer the questionnaire. We did a bunch of extensive cross-tabulations, which I want to share with you now, to see if male supervisors were overbearing, if pay scales were, quote, unfair, if marital status or age or education or background factors reported through on a sense of dissatisfaction or a desire to see organizational policy change in the agency. No clear relationships were discovered, except that negative feelings about personnel directors stood out. Now listen very carefully. There was 20% agreement that personnel directors were advocates for clerical workers with the administration of the organization. On the other hand, disagreement with the statement, personnel directors are advocates on behalf of clerical workers with the administration. Disagreement with that positive statement was 35%, and 30% were in the middle, uncertain, and 15% chose not to commit themselves. I guess they thought maybe that the survey material would get back to personnel directors or something. My conclusion is, in the light of negative remarks, positive remarks, the personnel director symbolizes the organization or the system. And thus, the director becomes a recipient of the full impact of alienation and dissatisfaction. All right, I'm going to take a couple of these in the form of the hypotheses as they were stated. Number one, lights on, gentlemen. We want to get an idea of how many women employees are dependent upon our agencies for their only source of income. We hypothesized that a majority of the women clerical workers were going to be dependent upon us as an agency as their only source of income. That was not true. In the administrative and executive positions, there were 55. This as a source fell short of the 50%. Notice the dotted line running up the side. That indicates if you pass that, you'd get to a majority. The technicians, the TX is technicians exempt from having to be paid overtime. The TN are technicians not exempt, so that if they were, those who are involved in personnel know the ticklish matters related to government identification there. They were the only ones, our technicians were the only ones that were really caught in the bind in terms of the organization. The rest, in all the various levels, did not depend in terms as a majority on their income from the agencies. We looked at a little bit of the reasons behind this, but it's in your study, and you can enjoy that as you will. Number two, though the size, that's right, we change them now. Okay, thank you. Though the size of paycheck is very important, we hypothesized that their higher priorities, all of the women employees, their higher priorities would be intangible benefits such as a good place to work, religious motivation, and opportunities for advancement. And this was validated. A majority of women in every category demonstrated strong support of the intangible benefits for working at an SBC agency. Now, we had what appeared to be strong negative feelings, but very clear identification that I just doubt if I could get all that much of a satisfying job outside of the agency. I like it here. It's on page 19 in your report, and you can read those. Even though I could use more pay, I think I'm being treated fairly. They disagreed with the statement, I feel like I'm being looked down on by my supervisor. They feel comfortable in their professional relationship with their supervisor. And as a reason for working here, it provides a sense of worthwhile accomplishment. So let's take number three and put it up. And you see how this goes. The dark green, out of those five statements, the dark green indicates those in these various levels where they agreed with all five of those statements. Four out of five is the light green, and that runs well over there, very strong. However, you can note a kind of slant as you move toward the secretarial, that's the SC, the abbreviation, secretarial, clerical, accounting, and service employees. But it's still above the midpoint. Number four, religious motivation. We had three items in the questionnaire. One, I feel I have been called of God to do the type of work that I'm now doing. The second statement, in terms of reason for working here, to fulfill a sense of calling to Christian service. And the third statement was, out of a series of five, either one of these two, I came here to work because it is a religious organization, and two, I felt led. Wait a minute, I got to change that. I got to read it the way it was written. I felt God led me to work for Him here. Now put up number five. Well, that's four. Hold on, four. So you see how that runs across. Over 80% in the executive administrative. Approximately 80% in the consultant, editorial, and faculty categories. 35 fell in that consultant, editorial, faculty. Okay, number five. Opportunities for advancement. We had two statements. One statement, this organization is as open as it can afford to be toward both men and women. Second, professional positions are open to anyone with skills and experience. And you will note, then we got five up, right. Those who agreed with at least one of those, it moves across that halfway mark. But you do see that slant as you move toward the secretarial, clerical, and accounting. So I would say that's fairly well supported. But there's a whole lot of positive in all this, and I feel very encouraged by it.
Thank you, Dr. Wood. And thank you all for giving us this chance to be part of this consultation on women. We have passed out some worksheets that you may be looking at as I talk or take home with you to study later. This first section in your worksheet that deals with the creation narratives is not just to give you two interesting little stories to read again, but to help lay a foundation for our study on biblical perspectives on woman. Am I coming through? Are you hearing me all right? Good. This is foundational, and we must look at these two narratives as we begin our study on woman. The more familiar narrative is in the second chapter. This is what we call the rib story. In this story, man was created, and then the lower animals. And then later, you remember, because of the aloneness of man, woman was created from a rib taken from man. Usually, when we read this story, it seems a very lovely, romantic story, and we have the picture of woman standing by the side of man. And yet, as we stop to think about it, is this really egalitarian? Or did she get there as an afterthought? If she was created to be a helpmeet, is this equality? Perhaps helpmeet is equal. More likely, there is a measure of subordination in being a helper. This story has had tremendous influence all through the years, right down to the present day. It's given lots of encouragement to the born chauvinist. But what about to the women? For the gifted, free-spirited woman, all too often, it has forced silence or quiet desperation, perhaps rebellion. It's a different story for the woman. The other creation narrative is given in the first chapter of Genesis, and this is normally called the priestly narrative. It probably took shape later than the rib story. Probably after the Babylonian exile, 300 or 400 years after the first story was formed. And scholars usually agree that this was placed before the rib story to override it. This sounds a little strange to our ears, because if we want to overcome something, we just wipe it out and begin again. But this was a pattern in ancient cultures. Today, you can see in the ruins of old buildings, one building built over and around an older one. Often these were sacred temples, so that the old was preserved, but the new was built over and around it. Not destroying what was there before, simply restructuring it. And we have something of this in these early chapters of Genesis. Let's look at that first one. The priestly narrative represents the creation taking place in which God formed male and female in his image and gave them dominion over all else that was created. This gives us quite a different picture, doesn't it? First of all, male and female were created together. Now, just among us girls, let's not quibble over the male being named before the female. We can take this all right, can't we? But we were created together in one tremendous act of creation in which personhood took the shape of two distinct but related creatures. The sexual distinction was there from the beginning, leaving no room for one self that would later be divided into two selves. We were there along with the first. Then there's a second thing that we want to notice, and that is in the image of God. We can't begin to fathom all that is implied in that little phrase. But we'll just say a few words about what it means for sexuality in God. We can never understand all that God is. And yet, somehow, in this mystery of creation, we partake of the femininity and masculinity that are bound up in the nature of God. And we are created in His image. Then there is a third aspect that we want to consider, and that is the commission that was given to them to have dominion over all creation. Partaking the nature of God, their dominion was not to be destructive. It was not to exploit or deplete creation, but to be creative, bringing light out of darkness, order out of chaos, harvest out of barrenness. They were commissioned to replenish the earth and carry on with God an ongoing creation, for His creative activity was good. Now, this creation story also has exerted tremendous influence through the years. We'll look at this in more detail as Frank takes over, for this is a joint project.
We assume that all of us look to Scripture for basic guidance, and I believe that this would be true of the Southern Baptist Convention. But beyond that point, we're not always together, because the basic question is one of hermeneutics. How do we read the Bible, which we all affirm? Now, many say that they hold to a flat Bible. It is all of equal inspiration and equal authority. But however loudly we proclaim that, there is not a single one of us who does that. Each one here and each one who reads Bible anywhere has a canon within the canon. This may be done consciously, deliberately. This may be done unconsciously. Look at the pages that are stained and worn in your Bible, and you'll see the working canon within your larger canon. So the real question that confronts us is this. It's a hermeneutical question. When we see what appear to be even competitive views in Scripture, how do we work our way through it? We've got to find the seat of authority somewhere. Evelyn and I would propose that the Gospels be included in our working canon. We would propose that we reaffirm the Lordship of Jesus Christ